Hello and welcome to QSO. It's all about ham radio and don't touch that dial. This week, we take a trip to Heil Sound. And for what reason? Well, because Bob Heil and a bunch of fellows from 3875 want to pay tribute to Bill Decker. And if any of you folks out there know about Bill Decker, then you obviously understand why. And if you don't know who Bill Decker was, then stay tuned, because you're about to hear a story. You know, we like to pay tribute. I think it's a good thing to, I guess I want to say, keep ham radio history alive. Some of the greatest folks that have been in ham radio that have brought all kinds of things to this world in terms of technology, fellowship, fun, and have added so much to the hobby. I think it's important that we take the time to recognize those people. And that's what we're doing today on QSO. It operates 20 through 10 meters. It's stealth. It will keep up with any three-element beam and any vertical that you have on your property. But if you can't have a three-element beam or a vertical on your property, you can still have a TW-2010. It is stealth. It disappears. We tried to take pictures of it, and we had to move the thing around because it hides so well. There is no compromise in performance with this antenna, and it's portable. You can take it with you on vacation. It's quite unique. They make several flavors of this antenna, however. If you want to operate 80, 40, 60, 30-meter band, it's all there. Go to their website and check it out, transworldantennas.com. That's transworldantennas.com, and check out the special pricing right now.
If I grab another mic, I'll jump in. Well, we're here at Heil headquarters is where we are, the world headquarters for Heil Sound, and we've got a group of fellows sitting here at the table, and they share a common interest, and a lot of that common interest goes back to 3875, a frequency on the 75-meter band, and their activities from some time ago is they would get on and do what hams do. And sitting across the table from me here is Bob Heil, and I'm going to hand this mic over to Bob and let Bob... I want you to interview these fellows and talk to them and tell the stories, because there's some good stuff here to be told.
Thank you very much, Ted. We appreciate you coming today. We're all here for a real special reason today, and that reason is what's central in all of our minds here today is true ham radio the way it existed for many, many years, and it's been lost lately. And the nucleus of the meeting today centers around a gentleman by the name of Bill Decker. Bill is passed on now, and he's made a big hole in all of our lives. Bill was a builder. He loved to build things. And I want to introduce you to some of his dearest friends that met with him every night on 75 meters, but they also gave him parts and loaned him things and traded things and so on. And they came here today to pick up a transmitter that he had built for one of our other members, who was Bill Dennison, who lives in Springfield, Missouri. And this transmitter was built for Bill as kind of a gift. But it had parts that almost all of the guys here today gave Bill Decker. And he built this incredible transmitter that Steve's going to get to take back home and put on the air as a tribute to Bill Decker. First up, we've got Bruce, W9OTN. Bruce, you're from Valparaiso, Indiana, right?
That's right, northwest corner of Indiana.
Yeah, and then we've got Bob George. Bob,
Bob.
It's really good to see you today. Your call, and you from?
I'm from Shawnee, Kansas, K0ZDQ.
Right. And then we've got Cliff.
Yes, Cliff, K9JTS, and we come from Southern Illinois, Carbondale, the home of the Salukis.
The home of the Salukis.
The Salukis. And the the gathering of this group, I think we all share this lust for building. Nobody did it better than Bill Decker, however. And when I look at the things I'm fighting with, I wonder if it's worth it. Because when I look at his, he was a craftsman supreme. And not only did his things work, they were gorgeous.
Yeah.
And so that's why they still live on after Bill's death.
Absolutely. And the guy that's going to make it live on in one respect is Steve. Steve, it's really good that you came all this distance today.
Thank you.
Your call? And
my call is KB4DMF.
And you're from?
I live in Clarkson, Kentucky, neighboring town to Litchfield, where Bill resided.
Bill resided. You spent a lot of time with Bill, didn't
yes,
you?
Yes, I did.
In person. Well, you guys just kick it off and let me kind of sit back and tell some stories about Bill. And I guess, Bruce, you can relate to some of this. I saw those coils today, and here I found out that the coils in this transmitter you gave to Bill, and that's what's kind of started the thing, I guess, huh?
Yeah, when you get a couple of builders that get together, Bill would come down my basement, and he'd look around, and he'd say, hey, you got any use for that? No. He's, I think I could make something with that, and then a couple months later, I'd make a trip down to Kentucky and be wandering around his basement in his area and find a few things that I could use. So there was always a lot of parts that got traded back and forth. And when we started looking at this transmitter today, I recognized the plug-in coils that that I had supplied for this thing. And that was part of the fun of it. When you're building amateur radio gear, you never have it all. So you've got to depend on your friends to kind of help you out. And a lot of parts changed hands and got traded back and forth. And that was a lot of fun. You know, that's part of it.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. Bob, you how long have you known Bill?
Probably 20 years. I'd have to think about that a little bit, but at least that.
Mm-hmm.
Met Bill on the radio. I the first time I ever talked to him, I was looking for a filament transformer to run some mercury vapor rectifier tubes, which I like to fool with, and he had one, and he sent it to me. And it eventually went into an amplifier that I built, and it's still there working today.
Typical Bill Decker. He'd hear somebody on the air needing a part, and he'd break in and say, I've got one of those. What's your address? He's done that to me several times. And you just, in the mail or whatever, you get this part. So
yes.
Amazing. So amazing.
I met him through Jimmy Isom, KJ9T. I've been talking to Jimmy for, 25 or 30 years, and marveled at his mobile.
Yeah.
Applications, which he did so well, and liked to work with him on that. And he introduced me to Bill a long time ago, and he was a fun guy to talk to. The things, if I think about Bill and think about what he'd want somebody to say about him, I think the most important thing to him was he was a Christian.
He was.
Oh, my, yes.
Yeah, every Sunday.
And lived his life with that as the guiding light.
All right. Every
and
Sunday.
I think that's what he'd want to hear.
Yeah, he would play guitar in his church and sing. I gave him a couple of microphones for his choir and for his solo stuff. Yeah.
When he even used to go down to the jail every Christmas there in Litchfield, they had a great big fancy county jail that they'd built, and he and some of the other church members would go there every Christmas several times during the holiday season and sing Christmas carols and things like that. Were the prisoners there?
No, that's great. Well, Bill was he was a unique person, and he was so kind. That was the whole deal. He was a kind person. How long have you been talking, Cliff?
Oh, probably 15 years, and had the pleasure of having a fishing trip with Bill the year before he died. And he's a pretty good fisherman. Now, he brought his brother Glenn along, and they both really enjoyed it. And he was really looking forward to fishing again, and he never quite made it. And that's one of the things that sort of makes us get involved in this a little bit. We all have basement fulls and garages full of parts and pieces, most of which, well, some of us can find it. Bruce can find it.
Yeah.
I have to look for 3 days, a 3-day trip to the pole barn to find it. And nobody's going to use it but us. I've hauled it to Dayton in the years gone by to the Ham Fest, and these young guys come along. They don't even know what it is. They certainly don't want to buy it, and they ask you maybe a question or two, but they don't even hardly know what a tube is anymore. And so this stuff, if we don't start giving it away, we're going to have our widows working with this stuff for a long time, and I know what they're going to do with it.
I always tell a lot of people that I know will get into different sessions and stuff, and they'll say, well, how come you have all of this old stuff? And I said, well, I'm a ham radio operator. I said, well, what's that got to do with us? I says, we don't throw anything away. And typical is the coil story with the Bruce. You know, here's these coils. What are you going to do with them? Well, you can't throw them away. And one day here comes Bill Decker, and it's out in Steve's truck about ready to be fired up. I bet you're really happy about this, aren't you, Steve?
Yes, I am. You know that I've settled Bill's estate since his death, and I saw some of his, I saw all of his transmitters when he built them and so forth. And there was one in his station at the time when he died, and that has since gone to someone else. He had prearranged that before he died, and I came away from the estate with the Arc 5 or command set. Modifications that he had made. He had built a transmitter out of them. And so I never dreamed that, you know, I'd actually have one of his transmitters, right. One of his larger ones anyway. So, yeah, I'm tickled to death to have it. It will be in my shack until the day I die.
Well, one of the really cool parts about this whole story is that Bob and I would visit a lot down in Springfield, Missouri, where Bill Dennison lives. And every Saturday morning, he'd hold court with all of the locals, and we'd talk about things around the old fire, as we used to say. After he got this transmitter that Mr. Decker built, Bill Dennison would roll it out in the middle of the room like a potbelly stove, and we'd all sit around and marvel at it and then talk about other things. It was just so unique. And when I called Bob, it's been a couple months ago, when I resurrected this out of the building that Bill Dennison was in, and they were trying to renovate this thing. It was just full of dirt and stuff and piled high, and I'm going, oh no, Bill Decker is not going to be happy if he looks down on this. And so Janice Sanders, who was Bill's assistant there, Bill Dennison, in their business, she had been talking with Bob George about it, and I came down a few weeks later, and I had an SUV, and we resurrected that transmitter. Sarah and I were so thrilled. We got it out of there and brought it back up there. Didn't know exactly what was going to happen, but today is the center of what's going to happen. And what happens to the whole deal? Bob George was there a few weeks ago and opened a drawer in a desk. You had to stumble through how many piles to get to it, right? And it was just awful in all of their...
had to move quite a bit of stuff to get to the desk.
Yeah, and when he opened that drawer, here is Bill Decker's handwritten notes about how he built this transmitter, how to tune up this transmitter, and how you will operate it. And you have all of those wonderful notes. So what a great thing. It's a classic story of ham radio, the way all of us grew up. And to put a little personal part of it, it's been my education. I've done a lot of wonderful things in my life and been able to build a lot of things and change people's life with some of our products. I have people all the time ask me, what college did you go to? Well, I didn't go to college. And what university, where'd you learn this? Amateur radio. Yeah, you're right. No, not your hobby. How did you learn to build this stuff? I learned this stuff by hanging around Bruce and Bob and Bill and Steve and all these guys that taught me as a child how to build. And that's what amateur radio was for me. And hopefully that'll continue, and we will have some be new hams that are going to pick up this building, because it's so much fun to design something and you blow a few things up and you see them destroy a few things, but eventually it works. So you're going to get to fire this up and put it on AM, and won't this be great, Steve?
Yes, it will. I've got a spot dedicated for it already.
All right. That's great. Anybody want to say anything about anything else that's going on in their life in amateur radio? We're all...
I notice an increase in activity on guys that are working AM, especially on 160 meters and, and 75 meters. It's picking up, and I think that's a good thing. There's room for AM and sideband, and of course all the digital modes. There's a spot for everybody in amateur radio, and some of us sitting here at this table have a special spot in our heart for AM because we grew up with it. We've all been kicking this hobby around for 50 years or so, and but anyway, I'd like to see a few more builders out there. But you know that let's hope that happens.
Yeah. What year did you get your license?
1955. So I've been soldering wires together and building transmitters for quite a long time, and I remember the first transmitter I had just a 6V6 in it. That's all it was about 5 or 10 watts, and I didn't even have a tube. But my parents had this, I think it was a 12-inch Emerson television, and I unscrewed the back on it, and in the right rear corner of the TV was the 6V6 audio output tube, and you know, I would sneak that tube out of there, take it down the basement, and plug it in my transmitter, and I had to be sure and get that tube back in there before my dad came home from work, so because he wanted that he never knew what I did, so that was kind of fun.
If he came home without any audio on his TV, he knew where it was, right?
Yeah, well, fortunately, I got the tube back in the nick of time, most of the time.
Isn't that great? Bob, when did you get your license?
I don't remember for sure. It was either 1959 or 1960.
During the good years.
Yes.
Boy, that sunspot cycle was high, and we were having a big time.
10 meters was rolling pretty well then. Yeah. I was a kid in high school at the time.
Wow.
And kind of started like Bruce did. I didn't steal anything out of the TV. Well, I begged, borrowed, and pieces and parts here and there and built my first little transmitter. I think it was a 6L6, and built a receiver. That's what I got on the air with.
Wow, you built a receiver. That was tough to do.
Most of it was.
Yeah, we built the transmitters. That was easy. So
it really wasn't all that much of a receiver, but I could hear people.
But it worked. That's
it
right.
Worked.
What about you, Cliff? What year did you get licensed?
1957, March 11th. I remember that day. I remember my first contact. Her name was Holly. It was a girl down in Texas.
Oh, my.
I was so excited. Never met Holly, but I think about her all the time.
Oh, there you go. You should look it up, right?
But the neat things about what we're doing with the old stuff is at least you can see it happening. You can feel it. You can follow a circuit and know if something's not working here, it's got to be here. Whereas when I open up the top of a solid state rig, I don't know what anything in there is doing. I have no idea. You know, it's a bunch of piece of black plastic, you know.
Yeah,
and if it smokes, it's usually all of them, you know, and you don't, and they don't even catch a fire like some old radios do.
Oh,
so I think that's been the fun part again. And that's why there's an increase in the AM, as guys are getting more interested in how a radio works rather than just turning it on, like we say, the appliance operators.
That's right.
You know, they want to see how things work. And I think that sparked some interest. Hopefully it's enough.
Yeah. When did you get licensed, Steve?
I must be the young one in the crowd. I got my license in about 1980.
Mm-hmm.
But the first transmitter I used to make a contact was a homebrew. It was solid state.
Yeah.
But it was homebrew.
Wow.
Kid receiver.
I was licensed in 56, and it was just a remarkable time because the sunspot cycle was high, and I still have my Harvey Wells on the air and on AM that I used in those days. One of the funnest things that I do is Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock on 14292. 14292. It's a vintage sideband net. It starts out at noon as the Hallicrafter net, then it turns into the Vintage Sideband, and at 3 o'clock it's the Heathkit net. Now, these are central times. You hear some of the darndest things because they're all old vintage transceivers and transmitters and receivers, and it's just great to hear this old stuff, Central Electronics and LDCOs and Heathkits, and we're keeping this old stuff going, and you are exactly right, Bruce. We're hearing a lot of guys are going to Hamfest and buying a DX100 for $50 or whatever and go home and make it work because they can't do that with their $7,000 import radio. They can't touch it. I have some of those, as all of us do, but you think I'm going to open the top on this thing and fix it? There's no way. I have one of my Kenwoods in a repair shop right now, and I wouldn't dare get into that thing. That's crazy. But I'll open that Harvey Wells or that HT37 or whatever and get right in it because, as you said, Cliff, you can follow it right through, and you don't have to be an engineer. You can just see how it goes. But that's all fun that we here in this room enjoy. And Bill Decker was one of those great teachers that would get on the air at night and kind of subliminally help us and teach us. And I want to say one thing in closing. I got into the 3875 group late. I've only been there for maybe 8 or 9 years. And one of the very first times that I heard Bill Decker, he came on the air and he said, "I want all of you to meet me on here at like 8 o'clock. Oh, okay. I never heard this before. This isn't a net. It's just a bunch of guys that hang out on this frequency. And you know what's going to happen when you get there because it was all about camaraderie and enjoying ham radio and building. But here's a guy that said, I want you all to be here. I'm going to make an announcement at 8 o'clock. So I come back in to listen to see what that announcement was. And that announcement was Bill Decker coming on to say that he didn't appreciate the fact that he was hearing some language and some direction of the people operating this frequency. And he said, I don't like it. And he says, I can't tell you what to say, but if I'm going to be a part of this group, I do not want to hear some of these words that I'm hearing. And what he was talking about, there were a couple of interlopers that weren't part of that group. Not that we have a group or a net or a club, but there were people that really hadn't been there for years and years. They were newcomers to ham radio, and they kind of got their language a little out of kilter. And that's some of the things that I hear today that I don't condone either. Bill Decker, he nailed it right there. And that was the end of that. I've never heard any of those people again on that frequency, and I've never heard that happen. And it just kind of cleaned up the frequency. It was, to me, really a bold statement by a man that was convicted of his Christian attitude in his life, and he didn't want to see that follow through to his great hobby that he loved so much, and that was Bill Decker. And I really miss him a lot, and I hope that we can continue the tradition. And I appreciate so much of Ted Randall bringing all of his stuff today and putting this story up so the world can hear it. And I hope that they all get to tune to 3875 and hear Steve with this wonderful transmitter. And, of course, you'll be on 3890. You won't be on 75 with it because 3885 to 3890 is the AM frequencies. Yeah. But we'll be there with you. I'll fire up the old Harvey Wells, and we'll see what happens.
See what this thing sounds like.
Absolutely. Well, that's my closing remark about Bill. Anybody have anything they want to add?
I just wanted to say that we sure miss him, and I'm glad we're here honoring him.
Yeah, true. Well, thanks so much, Ted, for being here today and all the WBCQ and the shortwave listeners. We hope to hear you on the amateur radio band someday. It's very simple to get a license today.
Sometimes I think it may be too simple. I don't know. I'd like for you to do one more thing, if you would, Bob, because we do have an incredible amount of shortwave listeners listening, a lot of them of which want to become hams. And we've also got a lot of the new technicians that listen and listen by way of podcast, not necessarily sometimes on shortwave, but they're listening on iTunes. I'd like for you to do one more go around and have these fellows tell individually And I don't want to hold you up because I know you're waiting to get to dinner here. But anyways, and you can tell he's a ham because he picks the microphone up off the table and pulls it right up to him, and he gets the exact distance he needs to be away from that diaphragm. He knows how to use it. So if you could just have them go around one more time and talk about what the original thing was that sparked their interest, that got their attention going in the way of amateur radio. I that would fascinate me. I'd like to hear this.
Okay. I first was exposed to amateur radio when I was in the seventh grade. We had a radio club at the grade school, and the geography teacher was a ham, and we had a club meeting every, I think it was Wednesdays after school, and back then you could buy J38 telegraph keys for 39 cents, and he'd bring a bunch of them in, and this old code machine from the U.S. Army World War II, and he exposed a lot of us kids to amateur radio, and that's when I first got my license, was through the radio club at the Edison School Radio Club. Mm-hmm. And I think I was about 13 years old then, so
wow.
That was an interesting time.
Great. What about you, Bob? Where did you first learn about ham radio?
My mother actually mentioned it, because when I was a youngster, I liked to listen to the radio, and of course the radios were old and somewhat of an antique, and you had to hook a piece of wire to it to stretch it out across the yard. And it used to be something I just marvel at. How can I hang that piece of wire outside and actually hear people with it?
Yeah.
And one day she told me, she says, well, there's actually people that talk to one another with a piece of wire like that. She said, your uncle used to do that back during the Depression. He did. And so I got a hold of my uncle, and he started telling me, that's ham radio. And he got me a book. It was an ARRL publication, How to Become a Ham Radio Operator, or something along that line. And I read that book and said, would you look at this? And I never got over that, how I can hang a piece of wire up in the air over the house or from a tree or anywhere and use that to talk to somebody hundreds of miles away, right, just like we are here at this table, mm-hmm, that easy. And how marvelous that was that could happen. I didn't have to have a piece of wire 500 miles long. I could do it with a radio signal.
Wow.
And that's something that's never ceased to amaze me.
Yeah. What about you, Cliff? How'd you get started, or how did you turn down?
Father was walking through the 100 Northwestern. Allied Radio. And servicing their cafeteria for the employees.
Oh.
And he walked through the ham shack. And he knew, when I went to bed, there was always two things in my bedroom. In the summer, there was always a fan. But all year round was a small AM broadcast radio that I went to sleep with. And it was on my pillow. And I marveled at listening to AM broadcast stations all over the United States and Canada late at night. You know, you could listen to the Clear Channel and sure, WWL and all the stations that you could hear. And so he brought home these three books, the ARRL publications, Code and How to Become an Amateur Radio Operator, and the license book.
Hmm.
I read them in one night. And I was hooked. The next thing I did, I borrowed from a guy that's an AM nut out in California, a guy named John Staples.
Hmm.
I don't know if you've ever heard of W6BM, and I was in high school with him. And he gave me a code oscillator, and about a week later, I took the test and was a novice. Wow. That's how I talked to Holly.
Oh, wow. That's
but,
great.
But it was my dad thought that, you know, as much as he listens to the radio, I think magically he wanted to do it. And I remember trying to teach him the code, and there was just no way.
Oh.
It's hard to teach 40 and 50-year-old people the code.
Yeah. Oh.
You got to do it when you're a kid.
Well, you got it. What about you, Steve? How'd you...
I think I was born one. I just didn't discover it until later. For as long as I can remember, I took things apart and made other things with them, toys mainly, you know, or unlike what's your name?
Bruce.
Couldn't think of his name. Unlike Bruce, I didn't put the tubes back. I got the old one. I got an old TV that was already bad, and marveled at when you break the glass around that tube, how delicate and they are, and all those other little parts that really look cool.
Yeah.
And then later in life, I had some interest in electronics, but not. Hadn't learned anything much about it, but was introduced to ham radio through my uncle at about age 17 or so on a visit to his home in Lexington. And he was a CW operator, net operator, and we'd spent a couple of nights there, and I got to watch that and was amazed. He was just talking to people around the state. It was a Kentucky net. But that spurred my interest, and wasn't long before he was also a builder, and so he was sending me schematics and parts, and wasn't long, I was on the air, had a license, and he was my first contact with that transmitter I mentioned a while ago.
That's great. I got mine. I was taking Hammond organ lessons from my organ teacher, and I'd go to his house. And we'd take an organ lesson, and his son was a year ahead of me in high school, and he was learning the code and to get his license. And I'd take my organ lesson and hurry up back to the back of the room and see what was going on, and it was George Crowder, my classmate that became K9DTQ, and shortly after I became K9EID, and it just changed my life. And I have to tell you one story that really, really got me fired up about ham radio. I got my license, and I had one of the Gonset communicators, 6 meters, a little square box, about a foot square. And I rushed home from school one day, and this thing had a receiver, and it was a crystal-controlled transmitter, and I started listening, and I heard a station from Cuba. As it was back in the days, now this would have been about 57 or 8 when we could talk to Cuba. CO2ZX, I'll never forget this. I called him. Now this is a little, 6, 8, 10 watt transmitter. And he came back to me. I have his QSL card, his confirmation card. Got finished with that contact, and I looked up. And this Gonset communicator came with a whip like the old car antennas, 54 inches long, that screwed into the top. I did not have my outside beam antenna screwed on. I had that little pull-up antenna. I talked to CO2ZX from Marissa, Illinois, on that little 54-inch whip on 6 meters. That's how good the bands were in those days. But let me tell you, I think about that so often, Bob, because you get so fired up. How can you put a piece of wire out and talk to somebody in Africa? Mm-hmm. Or pull up a little antenna and talk to a guy in Cuba? That was the fascination to me, and it really, really nailed this hobby for me. And I hope that everybody listening can join us. And it's easy to get the license today. It was very difficult for all of us. We had to learn the code. I think it was 5 or 6 times I had to go to the FCC offices, each one of us did, I think, and I'd flunk it a couple of times here and there. And it was about the 4th time before I ever got my license. But today, it's a whole different ballgame. And it's easier to do. The code is not required any longer on most of the tests. So the ARRL, American Radio Relay League in Newington, Connecticut, you can look that up on the internet, ARRL. They can guide you to your local clubs and people that can help you. Or you know what? Do like Joe Walsh did. Joe Walsh is WB6ACU, the guitar player for the Eagles. Yes, he's a ham. He's been a ham since a long time before he was a guitar player. And his story is this. He was in New Jersey, living in New Jersey, and he saw this big antenna on top of this apartment building, and he followed the coax line down, went into a window, and he went and knocked on that guy's door, and that guy helped him. It was his, as we call Elmer, helped him get his license, and Joe's kept in touch with him all these many, many years. And that's how it happens. Go find an antenna, beat on the guy's door. We're all welcome. Anybody that wants to stop by, I think we all share that. So, Ted, thanks so much for all of this. And again, it's a tribute to Bill Decker and real history of what happened early days and what can happen today on amateur radio.
Thank you much, Bob, and thank you guys for sharing. This has been really cool, and I'm sure there's a lot of folks that are really going to enjoy hearing the story of Bill Decker, and especially the story of this transmitter and each and every individual story that you guys have told about your beginnings in ham radio and what the hobby means to you and what it's given back to you, you know, as a hobby, which is something unusual. A lot of hobbies today, you spend a lot of money, but they don't give as much back as amateur radio does.
Bruce, why don't you give Jimmy's website, and we'll have pictures up there of all this. We'll put it on Jimmy's website. It'll be on ours, but I don't want to make a commercial. I think that'd be a good thing to do.
Yeah, I think so. A lot of the stuff we've been talking about this evening, and pictures of a lot of these transmitters, and this stuff can be found on KJ9T.com, KingJames9Tango.com. Stick that in Google, and it'll come up, and you'll be able to see a lot of transmitters and a lot of homebrew projects and a lot of what used to happen on 3875 years ago. It was a very technical type frequency. We had quite a group of guys in there that were builders and had very interesting QSOs every night, but don't hear too many builders anymore. So, right. But check out KJ9T.com.
There you go.
Week after week, you hear us talk about Transworld antennas, and you hear us talk about the TW2010, the 4040, the Backpacker, and all these different antennas. Of course, the TW2010 Adventurer came first. Folks were amazed at its performance. Then they introduced the Backpacker, and now the 4040. Go to EHAM and read the reviews on the TW2010. Just go to EHAM and read those reviews. Now, you can do that by going to transworldantennas.com. Just go to transworldantennas.com. Transworld Antennas, one word. Go to transworldantennas.com. There's a link on that page that'll take you right straight to the EHAM reviews. Or you can just go to EHAM yourself. And if you're a ham, you know how to get to EHAM on the internet. Just Google it. You'll get there. And read the reviews. See what other amateur radio operators are saying about this antenna. Thank you. At QSO, we've got a new prize closet, and we've got some interesting things going into that prize closet. Be sure and write us and send us that email that says, "I want to win." Put that in the text somewhere in that email and go to our website, QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com, and send us an email. Tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're listening, how the signal's coming in, or if you're listening by podcast. But be sure and put on that email, "I want to win," because we're going to have some really, really neat things to give away. We'll be putting those things up on the website and telling you more about them on the air. Be sure and don't miss out. Send us an email and put in there, "I want to win." Go to QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com or TedRandall.com, RANDALL, and we'll look for your email. Our guest today is Fred Lloyd, AA7BQ. He is the founder and the originator and publisher of QRZ. Hello, Fred.
Hello. How's it going?
I'm doing pretty good today here. I mean, we got, you know what's funny? Before we start doing these radio interviews, we get to talking on the telephone, and I get to thinking to myself, we got to stop this because he's telling a good story here, and we're going to miss the story. But we got to talking about equipment malfunctioning, and I had a little problem here with a telephone hybrid, and he was telling me that he had done some record spinning using remote lines years ago and had just started telling me a story about a radio station down in Florida. So I'm going to ask you to just pick up right where you left off, because this was getting pretty good.
Well, okay, Ted. thanks for having me on the show. We're just going down memory lane there and talking about radio. I actually got a job in broadcasting back when I was 19, maybe 20 years old, and that's because I, over the summer, I had played around and got a first-class FCC license, and there was a little 1,000-watt AM station in St. Petersburg, Florida, that needed someone that they could have on staff, because it was required back then to have at least one licensed individual on staff, and so I got the job. And you know, most of my duties were to read the play current and the RF current every day and put them in the log and watch the modulation. And then once a month, I think, it's been a while, I would drive around town and do field strength measurements. It was all great fun. I felt like I was really getting into the big time of broadcasting. The job didn't last all that long. I think I was there 3 or 4 months. And, I moved on to other things. But it was great. I got a press pass, I remember, at the time. And the nice thing about that was it got me in backstage at several concerts at the time. And so, I really enjoyed that part, being only 20 years old.
Yeah, at that time, radio, it transitioned. It went from a point where they had full-time engineers and separate disc jockeys. And, of course, then what happened was they lost the full-time engineering position, and they wanted the disc jockeys to have first-class FCC licenses in order to be able to sit there and take meter readings on a directional. And so, consequently, at that point, we had a lot of combo guys. We had a lot of guys that had first phones and would be DJs at the same time. But what happened was that it spurred a whole industry of schools at that time. There was places like, I think it was Elkins. Do you remember that? Does that name ring a bell?
It doesn't. They're not for me, no.
But Elkins was one of the schools that they would take you in, and they would literally drill the second class questions into your head and answers. And when you completed that class, you could go down and take the test. And it was kind of funny because some of the guys that took the test, they couldn't identify the difference between a resistor or a capacitor, but they had passed that second class license. And that got them the ticket. Of course, they had to get the first, I think, at that point. The jump between the second and the first, I don't think was that pronounced. The second one was the second class was the tough one, from ground zero. And they had to have that ticket. So they'd take that crash course, and the next thing you know, they were sitting in the DJ chair, but they were able to take meter readings. And that's what the business was all about back then. It was a little different. But
yeah.
I remember when there were engineers, they had guys sitting there all day long watching the transmitter, literally, and I often wondered, well, what would be the worst case scenario? I think it would drift off frequency, it would interfere with some other station, and they'd be made to shut it off. But hey, that was back then. It was real serious. And matter of fact, during the days of the full-time engineers, the announcers came to work in jackets and ties, and they were talking into Altec ribbon microphones. I'm too old, what do you think?
Yeah, well, another famous one was, of course, the Gates Yard Console. And, I'm sure you remember the reason it was called a yard was because it was 3 foot wide.
Yeah, those were very popular, and there was a lot of small FM stations that went on the air that were that used the yard. And the yard, it was available in stereo. It was stereo and mono, but a couple of the stations I worked at had yards, and they were just the mono versions. But had a pretty good-sized meter on the right-hand side. And it was a real short console. It was not very tall. And to contrast, if you remember, some of the ones that Gates put out were huge, and they had great big gigantic pots on them. They are the knobs on the Davin wire wound potentiometers, and they had different colored little things on. But they were big, huge consoles, big, huge meters. When you sat down, in back of one of those things, you kind of felt like you were driving a 57 Buick or something. They were big. Well, did you have an interest in, at that time, were you interested in amateur radio at all, or were you, how did that come about?
I was interested in it. I actually I got into CB radio when I was about 15, and I envied the ham radio guys because they had, of course, much bigger radios with a lot of power, and the band conditions were good back then. And I actually bought a big Helicrafter set, one of the old SX series, the transmitter, receiver, and kilowatt amplifier. But then didn't get the license and didn't put it on the air. I sort of really failed there. But it was at the time it was the Morse code that that slowed me down, and so I didn't do much else with it until I'd say about 15 years later, or more, maybe 20 years later, when I was living in California in the Bay Area. And hanging around ham radio outlet store there in my time off, you know, during the lunch hour, from I was working in high tech at computer companies, and in my time off, I go down to HRO and browse around, and finally I decide, okay, this is it. I'm not going to be beaten by this, and so I sat down and started learning the code, and you know, very shortly thereafter, got my first license. I was N6UFT, which was, let me see if I can recall, I believe that was a technician class license. And then shortly after that, within a month, I upgraded to advanced class, and I was KJ6RK. And a month or so after that, on a dare, I was at the Ham Fest at Sunnyvale. Someone dared me to take the test, and so I went and I read the license study guide while I was standing in line, went inside, passed the written, and missed the code by one letter. And so I came back a couple of weeks later and made my extra class license. So I always felt good about the fact that once I really applied myself to it and I made it up to 20 words a minute, I got all that done in about 60 days. So ever since then, I've been a ham, and that was in 1987.
Well, you know, I think a lot of it is focus. A lot of it is being able to focus. And unfortunately, in a lot of folks' lives, between work and all their other responsibilities, they just don't have the time to focus on it, you know, and if you can focus, it's really not that difficult. If you can spend the time, if you're able to spend a couple hours a day or even an hour a day, you know, at it, it's people are amazed. The folks I've talked to in the past were amazed at if they had the time and they could spend the time even with the code, how quickly the code would come. But then a lot of times, if you're left to yourself and there's no one there to kind of teach you or help you along a little bit, It's a little different, because back in those days, you know, we didn't have all the Gordon West CDs and all the other things that people have today. There weren't people around like Ham Test Online and things like that can help coach you through it. You had to get it out of a book, and sometimes there wasn't even an Elmer around. You kind of had to get it on your own, and I think a lot of folks got discouraged. Let me ask you this. You got started in CB radio, and there's a lot of guys that came up through Citizens Band. I'm curious as to what equipment were you working with when you were in Citizens Band?
At the time, it was basically tube radios that had crystals, individual separate crystals that you would buy down at Radio Shack for each channel. I remember brand names like Lafayette, I think. I can't even remember. It's amazing how quickly 30 or 40 years go by.
Well, the only reason I ask is because so many guys have come up that way, and I get into discussions with people, and I'll mention old Citizens Band brand names, and they go, oh, yeah, I had one of those. Oh, my favorite radio was. Well, see, I grew up in the Detroit area, and there was a company up there by the name of Multi Elmac, who also had made amateur gear, and they made some really cool AM mobile AM receivers and transmitters, but they put out a Citizens Band radio called the Citiphone SS, and it was a 23 channel, and I think the SS had something to do with the fact it was one of the very first synthesized radios, because everything else had been rock-bound. And then somebody discovered how they could pair crystals up into a synthesizer arrangement, and you know, they could put more than one crystal together at the same time. I don't quite understand how that all worked, but nonetheless. And there was companies, like you said, Lafayette. They had, good Lord, they had the Telstats and Comstat 25s and all these tube radios. And sometimes they're just fun to talk about. Now, the ones everybody wanted to own were radios like the Tram Titan and the Browning Eagle. You know, those were and I remember those guys who would trip. They had little boxes they'd connect the microphone up to, and when they'd key the mic, it would it'd make it ping, because the Brownings had this thing where the receiver stayed on for nanoseconds once you keyed the mic, and it would feedback just slightly and make this pinging sound, which I was always wondering what the function of that was, but I think it was just a kind of a trademark thing. But there's little toys you could get back then. There was the Demco power modulator. I don't know if you ever saw one of those things. It was a horrifying thing. You you plugged your D-104 into that, and then plugged that to the input of the mic, and it had a preamp, and it went into clipping and put out square waves, I guess. I don't know. But there was those and a little compressor amplifier called a Vibratrol. We won't even talk about the DNA company, the guys that made all the sweep tube linear amplifiers. But anyhow, I just didn't know if you recalled some of the radios you may have owned or some of the antennas you used.
Well, I don't recall that much about it. I do recall how impressed I was the first time I saw someone operating mobile, and it kind of blew me away, because he had an old tube radio. It may have been a Drake or something like that, or a Galaxy, in his car, and he demonstrated for me that he would rev the engine up and get those tubes glowing bright, and he made a 20-meter contact across the country, and I was blown away by that. I couldn't believe fantastic that was. But the thing that gets me the most is the fact that back then, two-way radio was really something. It was, only the elite people could talk on two-way radio. It wasn't something that was really within the reach of the average person until CB came along, and then it wasn't really in the reach of people that is, global or intercontinental communications, unless you became a ham. Today, however, two-way radios, people are brought up with them, and, the cell phone really has killed the mystique of talking wirelessly, and it's pretty nostalgic to look back at the days where people were really blown away by ham radio. It's kind of sad in a way, and we really have to keep trying to make the hobby interesting. And that's sort of plugging myself. That's one of the things I do with QRZ, is do things to keep the hobby interesting in today's context.
Well, I'll tell you something. The reason why I'm asking the questions about Citizens Band and all that is just so many guys got into ham radio because of Citizens Band. And, of course, Citizens Band was under a lot of fire, a lot of criticism, and a lot of the hams acted like they just absolutely hated it, it did produce some problems. There was a lot of pirating and renegading and all that kind of thing. But I look back on it, and I think Citizens Band was one of the best things that could have ever happened to amateur radio, because it got people in front of some kind of a rig. It put a microphone in their hands, and the ones that were serious about it could see the limitations, and they could also see what amateur radio had to offer was so much more. It was incredible what amateur radio offered compared to Citizens Band. But Citizens Band whet the appetite of the real serious guy, and the next thing you know, he's got a ham license. It's interesting. I can go back now, and I can look up some of the fellas I used to know back when I was real young. I was probably 12 or 13, and every one of those guys have wound up with ham licenses, because they found that the Citizens Band was just very limiting. And but you're right in that, cell phone technology now, when you talk to someone and say, well, you ought to get a ham license. And they'll say, what do I need that for? I can pick up my cell phone. I can call Hong Kong. They really, they kind of equate it to that, you know. But I still think the true experimenter, the person who really has an inquisitive mind, is going to be attracted into the hobby, providing they get exposed to it. And I think exposure is probably one of the biggest, I guess I want to say, catalysts to get somebody into ham radio. And that's where QRZ comes in, because it's an exposure tool. It's there on the internet. And I wonder how many non-amateur people, how many non-hams, people who are not even prospective hams, stumble across the site and discover the hobby by means of QRZ.
Well, I think, the search engines like Google, for example, contribute to that. There's been a lot of people that are found on QRZ because simply they Googled for a person's name and then it showed up in that manner. I can't tell you how many people have used our online test, but I know it's several thousand people have used our online practice tests in order to obtain their initial license. It's one of those things that, QRZ has been around for almost 16 years now, and there are people that did not know ham radio before QRZ existed. In other words, all they know about ham radio started with QRZ. I mean, there are people that have by now been hams for more than 10 years, and the QRZ to them has always been there. So I'm really happy to have done that, for the hobby. I never intended to start QRZ as a, what it ended up being is not what my original intent was. My original intent was born out of my own desire to simply get a copy of the database in a computer. My main hobby was always computers, and I wanted to see what it would be like to get the database going, and it simply morphed into what it is today. And so, I really can't claim, I really don't tell people that, I'm not the Al Gore of ham radio. I didn't invent it, but it was just necessity being the mother of invention. I got lucky and put together a website that now is close to being one of the most popular there are or that exists for ham radio.
All right, let me just tell you what I know. I had a little checking on that, okay? And there may be some folks that aren't going to be happy with what I'm about to say, but on several of the internet rating services, of all of the amateur radio websites that I put in, and I put in every website I could think of, QRZ has almost three times the traffic of the rest of the pack. So it's well deserved numbers. I mean, I looked at that and I was very impressed. I thought this is really cool, because one thing I like about the website is you've not incorporated a lot of things that make it difficult to load. So even someone with a low power computer and they don't necessarily have the fastest connection, they can still log in and they can still read the posts and the articles. They can see the ads. They can look up call signs. And the man that's got, he's got cable access or fiber running into the house, he's in fine shape too. But everybody can view the site, and it loads quickly and easily without a whole lot of, you go into some of these sites and you're sitting there waiting for all this flash to load. And, you're there for a little while. And I can't even imagine being on dial-up, but there's folks that are still doing dial-up. So we'll be right back with our special guest, Fred Lloyd, AA7BQ, the founder and publisher of QRZ.com, right after this. In this day and time, what we don't have much of is time. And if you enjoy operating and you just don't get a chance to, you need to take a look at the Trans World Antennas TW2010 and all the models that operate the different bands. Go to YouTube and put in Trans World Antennas and see how simple this thing is to set up. I mean, it is easy. It goes together fast. And of course, that gives you more time to operate. You're not fussing around with an antenna. in an emergency situation, it is absolutely necessary. You need to have one of these, if not for yourself, for your club, or whoever it is that may get called out on a scene where you've got to operate and you've got to be able to set up quickly and efficiently. Go to their website, and that's transworldantennas.com. Transworldantennas.com. There's a link up there to YouTube, and you can see how quickly this antenna sets up, how easy it is to operate. Transworldantennas.com. At QSO, we've got a new prize closet, and we've got some interesting things going into that prize closet. Be sure and write us and send us that email that says, "I want to win." Put that in the text somewhere in that email and go to our website, QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com, and send us an email. Tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're listening, how the signal's coming in, or if you're listening by podcast, but be sure and put on that email, "I want to win," because we're going to have some really, really neat things to give away. We'll be putting those things up on the website and telling you more about them on the air. Be sure and don't miss out. Send us an email and put in there, "I want to win." Go to QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com or TedRandall.com, RANDALL. And we'll look for your email. And now, ladies and gentlemen, back to our special guest, Fred Lloyd, AA7BQ, the founder and publisher of QRZ.com. With all that considered, now, let me say this. I have gone, this is one of the things I like about the site is, believe it or not, I like the ads. Now, a lot of people say, a lot of people, I'm sure, will say, "Well, I get, you know, these ads." But, you know, it's so cool because you see something pop up on QRZ, and it catches your eye. And you say, "Huh, what about that?" You click it, and you know what? Now you've learned something. You've got a whole new perspective of something. You've learned information about a brand new product, something that somebody's just put out. And I think that's completely, totally valuable. It reminds me of the days when we used to grab the magazines, even the handbooks, and stare at those ads for hours. You know, kind of like, I don't know if you ever got the old Lafayette, Radio Shack, and Olson catalogs, you know. And the people that tend to be on your site as advertisers are unique, at least in my book they are. When I click on them, I usually find something out new, you know, as I see a company I've never seen before. And I just find that real interesting. To me, I think that's valuable to a ham. It's to say nothing of being able to look up call signs. And I notice now almost everybody I know, when they're on the air and they're operating, they've got their computer on and they're on QRZ punching in the call sign of the next person that they're talking to. And it isn't that they're checking them out. It's just that it's interesting to find out. It's interesting to see on the map where they are. And a lot of those folks have put pictures up and they have links to their website. I mean, it's a whole different world. It's not like it used to be. You talk to someone somewhere and it remained a total mystery. I mean, even the geography of the area they were in, you had to look it up in Encyclopedia Britannica. Now, all you had to do is punt their call letters in QRZ and hit the Google map, and you can see where they are, and you can find out all kinds of cool things about who you're talking to. Well, you say this thing morphed. It wasn't something that, you started off with one thing, and it kind of took on a life of its own. What was the very first beginnings of QRZ? Tell me a little bit about how it all went together.
Well, QRZ started by when I was working at Sun Microsystems, actually, back in the late 80s. I was hanging around in my spare time on the Internet, and there were things which still exist today. They're called news groups on the Internet. And there was specifically a ham radio group that I used to hang out and read articles. And I learned from reading in that group that, which was text only, a person could actually purchase the database from the FCC by going through this procedure, the process from the, I think, what was it called, National Technical Information Service, NTIS, and you could order the tape, and So people were talking about that, but there was a barrier there, and the tape, and that was the price. The tape was somewhere between $600 and $800 to get a copy of the tape from the government. And so I thought, well, what if I get a copy of the tape and make copies of it and sell it to all of anybody who else is reading this group, and we could therefore split the cost, and it might get affordable. And so I got a copy of the tape. It was about, like I say, $600 or $800. I can't remember now. And it was on half-inch reel-to-reel tape. It was a huge tape. But luckily, I worked in a facility where we had tape drives for that. And so I transferred that to a quarter-inch tape. And then I put out an ad on the Usenet and told everybody, send me your quarter-inch empty cartridges and $20, and I'll make you a copy. And so right away, we recouped the cost of that. I think I sold 40 or 50 copies, and that was a success. So I didn't think much about it. I enjoyed having my copy of the database, and so did a lot of other people. 6 months went by, and it was time for an update. And I had come to the conclusion that copying tapes in my bedroom at home wasn't a lot of fun. So I thought, well, maybe we could use a CD. You know, it was a really new medium at the time. Not a lot of people had CD-ROM drives, but I thought, you know, it still made a lot of sense to me. I had previously worked in an optical disc company, and so I had a lot of fascination with that. And I found a publisher that was selling CDs that were stuffed with shareware. And so I thought, well, you know, the database is only about 60 megabytes, and I know a CD-ROM holds a lot more than that. In fact, they hold about 650 megabytes. So I called them, and I asked them, or wrote them, and I said, what do you think? Do you have space on one of your shareware CDs for a copy of this database? And they got back to me and said, you know, why don't we just do a ham radio CD? And I said, okay, well, that sounds great. So now I was in a panic because I had 60 megabytes of data and 600 megabytes of space, and I felt like, you know, I had to somehow fill that disk. So I went and gathered all of the ham radio articles I could find, anything I could find about ham radio, and put it all onto a CD and sent it to them. And they had me sign a little contract that said that they would pay me royalties and all, and that was fine, and I ordered 100 copies for myself, and they came, and I sold those the same way I sold the original tapes on Usenet, $20 a piece, and sold all 100, and thought, well, that's okay, that's nice, and didn't hear much about it after that. A few months later, maybe 2 months later, I was getting ready to go on vacation, and I thought, well, you know, those publishers said they were going to pay me a royalty, and I called them up, and they told me, well, oh, we're sorry. We forgot to put you in our accounting system. We'll take care of that. And, okay, that's fine. I went on vacation, and when I got home a few weeks later, there was a check waiting for me in the mailbox, and I just about fell over. I mean, it was a few thousand dollars, and suddenly I thought, you know, there might be a future in this business. And so I immediately started working on version 2 of the CD. And it wasn't. And around the same time, I started up a dial-up bulletin board in Scottsdale, Arizona, and put the database on that. Had several hundred users that were really happy about that. So the CDs were starting to sell through the regular CD channels pretty well. And since I was in the high-tech industry and had access to the Internet, I found a local Internet service provider that was selling dial-up Internet in the early 90s. I guess it was the mid-90s by then, 95. And they agreed to let me put QRZ on the Internet on a server that I owned. And that's how QRZ got started. It was really, really, really simple in the beginning.
Well, I guess the thing is that I remember years ago the only thing we had was the call book, and you got that like once a year, And a lot of times, hams couldn't even afford to buy the call book once a year. They'd have, you know, a call book from 2 years ago. And, it, you know, when you think about the drastic difference of owning a call book as opposed to being able to log in on a computer, that's, you know, that's really astounding. And, of course, it's so easy to navigate because the, you know, the, everybody knows the FCC site is so convoluted you can find something if you've got the time to really dig it out. And I don't know. I always dread having to go up to the FCC site if I'm actually really looking for something. Sometimes I'm better off on Google than not, and just leave the FCC site alone. But, well, all right. Now, while you were doing this, did you ever think at that point, you know, when you first started this, did you ever think that this thing would grow to the point where it is now?
Well, no, not really. You know, it really didn't hit me until about 7 years later when I was on vacation. This was in the late 90s. I was on vacation, and my wife and I were in the South Pacific. And I was still working for the computer company. And I took along a little shortwave radio with me, a little Sony Yacht Boy, and I'm sitting on a beach thousands and thousands of miles from anywhere, and I heard some hams talking on 20 meters, and one of them was on a ship and down around South America, and, you know, I listened to them talk, and finally one of them said, well, you can check me out on QRZ.com. And at that moment I thought, oh, my God, this thing really has hit. So that's about how long it took me to realize that it was really a kind of global phenomenon, and I just couldn't believe that, you know, anywhere on the planet, you know, QRZ was not only available but widely in use.
Well, I guess I don't know if you've thought about this, but if you go back a number of years and compare to today, you have field day locations that have the guys have their notebooks right there beside the field day station, and they're doing their logging. And they've got wireless internet or internet by some means, and they're on QRZ looking up call signs as they go down the log. You know, we just did our field day broadcast, and I talked to a number of stations across the country. They're all logged into QRZ during field day. So I think it's really marvelous, and I think it really speaks volumes for how the technology has developed over the years. And now, even though QRZ you would consider to be a pretty basic website and database, if we go back just a few years, it was like, you know, light years ahead of anything else that was out there. And now, of course, it's become staple. In other words, it's, you know, it's ingrained into the amateur radio fabric. It's as much a part of the amateur radio landscape as any other traditional organization that we have. That's just all there is to it. Everybody uses QRZ. Well, your background is computers, obviously, and you're talking about it was your original hobby. Tell me, what do you think? Where are we going with this? You know, I hear guys talk about, you know, Echolink and IRLP, and they say, oh, it's not amateur radio. I don't want a computer in my shack. But I think it's obvious the handwriting is not just on the wall. The handwriting is flashing on and off in neon that the computer and IT is going to be a key portion, if not the future of amateur radio. And I'm curious, what do you see coming down the pike?
Well, I think digital technology is making things available to us that not necessarily the internet, but things such as digital signal processing and advanced communications modes. These things are all making quite a difference. I mean, you can conduct, for example, communications now in conditions where before it wasn't possible. You know, advanced coding techniques, digital modes, things of that nature, digital radio, digital HF. You know, it's still a hobby where, you know, electronics and communications enthusiasts are going to be attracted, you know, for the most part. It will continue to be difficult, really, to get appliance operating Game Boy type people interested in. In other words, you know, today, you know, you offer a teenager an Xbox 360 and a high def TV, or you offer him, you know, a ICOM 7800 HF set. Which one do you think he's going to pick? Right? There's just, it's really difficult to get people interested in that sort of a thing. Certainly our equipment is going to get better and better, and for those of us that appreciate it, it just keeps getting better all the time. You know, we can hope that the bands will, the sunspot cycle will improve to our favor here in the near future, or at least in our lifetime. But, you know, I really don't know where the hobby is going. The outlook does not, to me, look all that great, to tell you the truth, because our average demographic is pretty old right now, and there's not a lot of signs of it getting younger. The attraction is not the same, as we discussed early on. You know, back in the day when two-way radio was really something, it was a lot easier to attract people than it is today.
Well, you know, I know that there is Winlink and there is D-Star, and recently I was in a conversation with several people, and we were kicking this around, and I'll just do it over the radio and throw it out in front of you. What if there was a way to create an intranet that would duplicate the capabilities of the internet, but it would be connected by means of RF? In other words, you would have no dependency on a cable connection, a DSL connection, or any sort of traditional internet wireless connection. In other words, this intranet, or maybe if you want to call it a clone of the internet, would be completely carried by amateurs, and it would be accessible by means of RF. Now, I was thinking about this. Now, this is way out there. But everything we've ever done in amateur radio has been way out there. The other thing, I mean, that's just an idea to kick around. But and I know there's D-Star and Winlink, and I don't know how all that would fit in, and I know they're opposing crowds and all that sort of thing. The other thing is that when you look at a Game Boy and you look at Game Boys, or I don't know, some of this stuff, the technology I'm not familiar with. What's the handheld things that they used to have? Well, those Game Boys, I don't know. Both of my sons have had those things, and I think those are outdated now. I don't know what's up to date. But anyways, the amount of advertising that goes into these things. In other words, amateur radio has no advertising at all. Nothing. We have nothing. There is no slick television commercials showing some young guy, you know, talking to some real sexy gal on the other side of the world, you know, using an ICOM or a Linko or a Yaesu radio. You don't see that on television. It isn't done, okay? So, in other words, we're really kind of, regardless of what the technology is or how much interest there is in the technology, we don't have the marketing to compete with those kind of things. So in a way, it's kind of an unfair advantage. Of course, although that type of advertising never existed to begin with in ham radio, even in the early days, but we weren't dealing with, you know, areas of the population that we're dealing with now. And I happen to agree with you. I mean, I hear all these people saying, well, you know, it's growing and the hobby is not dying and all that kind of stuff. I really do believe that unless amateurs today take action to make the hobby more interesting, to embrace new technologies, and to encourage younger people, I don't think the outlook is going to be all that great. Now, that's my opinion. You know, and I have two sons that are licensed hams. both work in radio engineering, and that's how I see it. Now, you're working with QRZ, and I don't want to get going down a doomsday path, but do you find the average QRZ person to be, what age would you say? Where do they fall in? The person that logs in and, does the login thing and checks in regularly, maybe puts a few posts up and that sort of thing. What is the average age of those people?
I would say over 40 and quite a few over 50. It's rare, indeed, that we have anyone that's... that's of the Game Boy age, to be frank about it.
Well, it could it be that there are those that just kind of go unnoticed?
Well, there are a few, but a lot of what goes on in QRZ is we have two real activities on QRZ. We've got the call book, which is number one. It's by and large 90% of what goes on QRZ is simply call book, and then there are the discussion forums, and the discussion forums tend to be very I want to say kind of tough, really. The stereotype of the the cranky old guy, is sometimes kind of appropriate on QRZ, and it can be very intimidating for a younger person to want to pipe in a discussion like that, because it's like sort of like talking to your parents almost. It's very tough for them, and so we started a group on QRZ for younger people, but it really hasn't gone anywhere, I think that's just kind of the nature of the beast.
Well, see, I guess maybe, and this is a good discussion to have, because I raised two sons, and I never shoved amateur radio at them. I never pushed amateur radio on them. And for heaven's sakes, if I sit back and think about it, I can't figure out what it was that really caught their interest, or what it was that really.
They saw Daddy doing it, right?
Well, yeah, but I mean, in a lot of cases, I mean, look at families. I mean, there's a lot of times the father is interested in golf and the kids hate golf. So what got their attention? I don't know, but I mean, I've got two sons that are fanatics. I've got my older son David, who is chief engineer for Trevecca Nazarene University here in the Nashville area, and he takes care of three radio stations. And he's got antennas up over there at the college, and he's got at the university, I should say, and has radios in there, and getting students interested in the radio broadcast side of what they do there at the university. And he's at one time I counted like eight antennas on his car. I mean, he looked, going down the road, it was heinous. I mean, it looked horrible. Eight antennas on this thing, I said, why do you have eight antennas on your car? Why don't you install a phaser, But then my younger son is chief engineer for the financial guru, Dave Ramsey, and they're on 400 radio stations, and they're on Fox television and all that. And he's got a Tar Heel, the largest Tar Heel I guess they make, on the back end of his Volvo. And he goes down the road and people look and they roll the windows down and they say, what's that on the back of your car? But I can't put my finger on it. I can't figure out what it is, because I didn't see any trouble at all. I mean, they had an intense interest in this thing without me even prodding. And now that they're licensed, of course, I've lost every radio I ever owned. So there is a risk in getting your kids into this hobby. Whatever you have becomes community property. If they need a microphone, you go up, you go to your ham shack, you sit down, the mic's gone, the speaker's gone, you're missing a soldering iron, an antenna tuner just vanishes for some reason. So there is a risk, and it's a good risk. But, I believe from what I've been able to see firsthand, I don't think it is a problem with younger people not having an interest. I think it's an exposure problem. Somehow, we're just not getting the hobby in front of these kids. And I don't know the answer to that. I really don't. I think that QRZ is a real, real good tool because it gives them a place to go online. They can actually go there and look at things and see things and all that. And if they do go into the forums and they run into fellas that are, you know, age of their parents, and the guys tend to be, you know, curmudgeons, so to speak, I guess, but that's everywhere in life. I mean, if they had an intense interest in golf, they'd run into the same thing at the golf club, you know, or the wherever they go to play golf. They'd run into that same variety of people. So I don't know, but I think we have to be cognizant of this. I mean, we got to look at this and say, well, how do we develop this out, or how do we gain their interest? And I don't know. I think some of the activities like field day and stuff helps a lot, but it still certainly isn't the end all of the answer. But you know, do you see? I guess I want to say the development of online stuff. A good example. Chris Matthew did an interview with you. I saw somewhere that you had talked to him, and he's doing a Facebook kind of amateur radio Facebook thing, and he produces some videos every week. I think those kinds of activities are going to be an asset to the hobby and help get younger folks, pull younger folks in. But at one point in time, you know, we were younger folks. So I guess my question is, you know, there's always been other things other than ham radio. What was it that pulled us into it? Now, you said when you saw the man operate mobile 20 meters out of the car that really got your attention. And I guess my question is what do we have today that's the equivalent to that? What do you think that would be?
I don't have a good comparison for that. I think maybe... Eris, perhaps, you know, talking to the space station. It's very hard, very difficult to say. Young people are so saturated with technology now that it's very hard to impress them. The amateurs used to be amongst the most technologically advanced people in town, you know, in your neighborhood. It's the ham guy that knows everything about electronics and all that. But today, not necessarily the case. We're being bombarded on all sides. I hate to be so negative about it, but I think the tighter that ham radio can interface with the internet and provide something that's unique, that's going to be the key, really. The way that certain things ebb and flow in terms of phenomenon, something will catch on, and once that happens, it's hard to contain it. That could happen with ham radio, you know, a phenomenon. A YouTube video, for example, that did something that was, you know, outrageously cool involving ham radio could spur a huge jump in our ranks amongst young people. But it's one of these things about internet phenomenon is that they're not very predictable, and it's very, very hard to create one. They tend to happen on their own, and that's really what we have to wait for. I will certainly help promote anyone that wants to do something like that. You know, QRZ will certainly throw its weight behind any kind of effort like that. But it's going to take some innovation and uniqueness to cause that sensation that's going to push us back into the spotlight.
Well, you know, one thing I did see that was interesting, a little story I'll tell. My son, Matt, was on his way to, I think it was Florida, with a group of guys. And he had his notebook with him in the vehicle. Excuse me. And I think he had a wireless card at the time. He just plugged the wireless card in and logged in wireless through the cell service. And brought up Echolink. And while they were traveling down the road in the car, he with Echolink, we logged into the local computer here in the Nashville area, and I talked to him over the repeater on my HT as I was downtown Nashville while he was traveling in the vehicle, and he was talking over Echolink on his notebook. And then when I logged off, he worked some guy in Germany, I guess, and a few other places on some other repeaters. And these guys on the vehicle, they were just amazed. I mean, it was like it just blew them away, you know. And yet I think most of us take Echolink pretty well near for granted. I mean, I don't think we use it to really demonstrate what can be done with ham radio. The thing that really got me, I just picked up a copy of one of the magazines. I don't know, remember which one it was. It was QSD or CQ, but it had to be one of the two. There was an ad for, I think, a new, is it Kenwood? I don't know. That's making a new radio that's got, it's got a Cat 5 connection on the back of it so that you can completely control it by the computer. But not just that. It also allows voice over IP operation. And I looked at that, and I thought, now there's something really, really cool. Can you imagine being able to take your rig at home and access it by means of a notebook anywhere in the world that you go? And that's one of those kind of things, you know, between Echolink, IRLP, the new data modes. It seems like the younger people I'm talking to are really interested in data modes. And so maybe that's the areas that we ought to be thinking about in terms of highlighting and developing and that sort of thing. And sad to say, I'm really ignorant when it comes to the data modes. My problem's time. I just don't have the time to fool with it. But boy, the people that get into it, they're really wrapped up in it. Now, are you familiar much with the data modes at all? Or are you familiar with how they operate and which ones are the most popular?
I haven't done a lot of operating there either. I am very impressed by some of the things that some of the digital modes that that use a lot of error correction and the sound card type of operations. Software like Ham Radio Deluxe, which I find to be very, very impressive in those in that realm. One of the things that that impresses me recently is one of the new radios that I saw introduced has a USB port on the back now, and I think that is really the key. With USB and direct access to transmit, receive, and both sides of the audio, you plug the radio into your computer and the computer looks at it like a remote sound card. Now we're talking. When we have something going like that, we finally have got an interface to the digital world that's solid. And in fact, it's the new ICOM radio, I believe, that does that. I forget the model number, but it's the one that just came out in QST. And it's not one of the big ones either. It's one of the lesser expensive ones, 7200 perhaps. But that's the key, I think. And as well as the ones that you mentioned, having the Cat 5 interface. I'm not aware of any of them now that are completely controllable over the Ethernet. But certainly there's nothing wrong with that. And, our future does lie in the digital realm.
Oh, I saw an article somewhere where a fellow had taken an ICOM 746 and used the computer cable on it and then used Skype to get the audio going to and from the radio, and was operating from his notebook. You know, just about anywhere he went, he could operate his home over the home radio. And of course, if you add a few little whistles and bells to it, you could change antennas and you could do band switching and all that kind of thing. I mean, it could get pretty sophisticated. A person could spend a lot of time doing that. I think that's really cool. The other thing, though, I think one of the things that has hurt our hobby. And and I don't want to get into a mudslinging contest here, but one thing that I think just has to go away, and that is all the politics that different organizations and little factions get into. It seems like, in my estimation, from what I'm able to observe, That's gotten much worse as time has gone on. I don't remember it nearly as bad when I was younger. You know, I remember the wars between AM and single sideband. You know, there was quite a conflict, you know, at the beginning of that. But I don't ever remember the politics entering into it. And that's something that I think everybody needs to keep in mind. The politics just needs to go. You know, we don't have any time nor space for that. You know, that's one thing that will absolutely extinguish the hobby. And that's that political involvement. You know, I think we need to dump that. The other thing I think that's killing the hobby to some degree, I think we're really over-focused on emergency communications. I mean, I want to do my part, and I think everybody else does, but it's got to the point now sometimes it's almost like don't use these frequencies unless it's for an emergency. These radios are for emergency. People want to have fun with these radios. They want to have fun with their radio. They want to get into this hobby because the hobby is fun. And I think what attracted people into Citizens Band years ago was the fact that there was a little radio community inside the place where you lived. You know, you would get on at night and you would talk to a dozen or more people, a little community. They'd get together, they'd have their coffee breaks and things. It was fun. And even back then, there was an emergency side. I think they had something called React or something like that. And these guys were on Channel 9 or whatever, and they had their public service side of things that they did. And amateur radio has really been famous for its public service activities. But I think we have got to the point where we have focused on that so much that we have lost a lot of the fun side of amateur radio. Now, do you think I'm wrong in this?
I times change. That's all I can say. Times change, and, you know, the world focuses on different things, and young people are excited by different things. To those of us that have stuck with ham radio all these years, it's still, if not more fun than it ever was. Our number one goal really should be to somehow bring the younger people into the hobby. I really strongly believe that there's no substitute for that. That's what we have to put our very best effort into.
Well, you know, I came across a situation here, and I may ask you the wrong question. If I ask you the wrong question and it's too political, just just change the subject on me here, okay? I'm bad about that. A situation came up here that I was privy to. Actually, two situations that I saw that kind of coming around. And you probably get a lot of that. You probably get some of it on QRZ when you get guys up there in the forums and they're exchanging ideas and whatnot. And that's all good, because I think the exchange of ideas and all that is where things get born. You know, this is where this gives birth to things, because ideas are where everything comes from. But I was driving along and I turned on a 2 meter repeater, and the severe weather was coming into town, or at least it was threatening. It wasn't actually severe as of yet. It was just the contemplation of severe weather. And they had activated this this net. And the net control guy came on, and he went a long time without saying anything. In other words, he activated the net, and they just went away. You know, and we were all just sitting there listening, and pretty soon somebody just pops in with a call sign on the repeater. Well, boy, I'll tell you what, that guy got a butt chewing. I mean, this guy comes out, he says, there's a weather net going on in here. And I mean, he started just laying into this guy. And I thought, now this is bad. I mean, this is really bad. Why don't you say, there's a weather net in progress, can you please stand by? I mean, that's all that's necessary. You know, and I'm sure the fellow would have said, sure. And he may have been a little embarrassed that he had thrown his call sign out. But once again, the man had time to turn his radio on and listen for a pretty good portion of time. I would say he could have listened 2 minutes, 3 minutes, and never heard a transmission. Not everybody keys the mic and says, is the repeater in use or is the frequency in use? Some folks, if they don't hear anything for a while, they just throw their call sign out there. And I know I've done it. I don't know how many times, probably too many times to count. Well, this guy took his tongue lashing and I guess he just went into the standby mode. And I would say it was no more than maybe 10 minutes later. We went through a period of silence on that repeater. It went for a pretty good while. And another gentleman from out of state tossed his call sign in. And, boy, he got his, you know what, chewed out as well. And I thought to myself, now, this has gone too far. I mean, this is where the emergency side of it has become insane. This is not a good thing. This is not goodwill. This does not promote the hobby. So I shot an email to the fellow, and I just told him, I said, I just don't think that's rude, man. Don't do that. You know, I mean, these people don't have any way of knowing that there's a net in progress. I mean, even if you listen for a few minutes, I mean, it's 2 meters, and 2-meter traffic tends to be really transient. So I got this email back that says, well, I used to do this in some other city, and that's how I did it, and da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And I thought, well, couldn't we just be nice? You know, couldn't we just be nice? Blind kids were on a repeater here in town from the blind school. And on a sunny day, not a cloud in the sky. And they decided they were going to get on a particular UHF repeater and talk a little bit. And it was just a few minutes. Guy comes on and says, you're going to have to get off of here. The National Weather Service monitors this frequency, and they don't want to listen to this. And I thought...
My opinion is that is really baloney. No one owns a frequency. I think everybody knows that. It's hard to make the case that you're interfering when the airways are dead. The self-importance of some of these operations is what gets to me when probably the event that you're talking about was just a sort of a watch, right? People were watching for bad weather, that doesn't mean that you get to own the frequency for the duration of the weather event. It's different if it's a warning. In other words, in weather terms, if there's an actual storm taking place right now, and there's a threat, but just an event like that, I have a real, real hard time, coming on board with the idea that you can't just casually check in. I agree with you 100% that for the guy to be dressed down like that, which amounts to basically a public flogging for something like that, that is rude, and there's no call for it.
Well, I guess my point is that I agree in that emergency communication is imperative for amateur radio. You know, it justifies our existence. But it depends on how far it's going to go, and I mean, if it is that we are there as servants, I mean, I ran into a local law enforcement man here that after we had a major thing happen here, a big fire exploded at a gas main or something, I don't know, but man, there was flames going in the air forever. And Matt, my son and I, we drove out to the location, and the law enforcement sheriff at the time, he just turned around and said to me, so, well, are you here to take over and control and tell me what to do? And I wasn't even there I wasn't even acting in the capacity of a ham. Of course, now, he was teasing me because he saw the antennas on the car, and he and I are acquaintances. I'm not going to say we're close friends, but he was teasing me. He was just making a joke of it, And I thought, that's really horrible, though, that has become part of his humor. That somebody has obviously behaved in such a way. So I just want to say, I think that one of the things that's missing is the fun. The other part is the courtesy, the courtesy amongst hams. That seems to sometimes be at an all-time low. And I think that hurts the hobby some. I really do. I think especially the like you said, the self-importance of some of the on-air situations that go on that take over good manners and the public floggings and that sort of thing. But now let me ask you this, because I don't know, do you run into that a little bit on QRZ? Does that present itself as a problem there as well, or is this more of an on-air problem?
Oh yeah, we have all types on QRZ. There are people that will that basically look for times, or, you know, look for the opportunity to jump in and cause trouble. They take pleasure in, you know, causing other people grief, just, you know, just by the use of words. And that's why we have moderators, and, you know, we try to keep that curtailed as possible. But it's, I'd say, worse on QRZ than it is on the air, because people seem less afraid. They know the FCC is not going to bust them on QRZ, but we still don't tolerate obscenities or anything like that. But you'll be amazed at how explicit people can be and not use a single dirty word. It's a constant job for us, and it's not only just obscene messages and things like that, but just rudeness and people that bait each other, things of that nature. You know, I say it's a problem, but you know, it's a tremendously small portion of our overall audience, a small portion of our membership. It's the rule that, you know, 2% of the people, you know, cause you 98% of the problem. And I can't say how grateful I am for all the help that I get on QRZ from both the staff members who are all volunteers and people that just come along and drop me a note saying, hey, you know, I think this is out of line, or someone here is causing a problem. I can't read everything that's on QRZ. There's no way I can do that. And thanks to, you know, all the good guys out there, that's what really makes it work.
Well, just exactly how many moderators do you have that kind of help you oversee the whole operation?
There's about 10 people, plus a couple of very very gifted administrators that help out a lot, too.
Well, that's very, very cool. Yeah, I think with the forums there, much like on the air, you know, I really think that if you got a grievance with someone, send them a private email. You know, send them an email. Don't bother the entire group with it. You know, I mean, if somebody really posts something that sticks out, don't you think other people know that? Don't you think that other people reading it can realize that, you know, that whatever that is that's sticking out is out of line, and the person is just probably looking for attention, you know, trying to bait somebody on, and they've got to do it in front of the group because it's look at me, you know, that kind of thing. You know, it just seems like if you have a grievance, I've always been more comfortable sending a private email than I would by answering a post. Matter of fact, I don't think I've ever answered a post except maybe once or twice, and I did that very delicately, and that was only because maybe somebody had put some misinformation up or something on a, and I'm not talking about QRZ, but I'm just talking about online, period. You know, and I don't know. There's been times I've been a little outspoken about things that maybe involve the government, you know, some oppressive side of things that we're all having to put up with. You know, I might make a comment about that. But, my goodness, I guess it goes back to the old rule of religion and politics. You know, if you get into that, you're just asking for trouble. But it's remarkable to me, though. I mean, I see a lot of discussions. And I've went up to the discussion boards, and I've looked at a lot of those things, and I'm amazed at the technical stuff you find up there, where somebody asks a question, and all of a sudden some guy comes out of the woodwork, and man, I mean, he knows all about it, and he, within a matter of four sentences, he answers all the questions that the person had, and I think that's really cool because you've got this pool of resources. That's hard to get on the air. I mean, it used to be years ago. It seems like I used to be able to get on a frequency and ask a question about a radio or something, and always somebody would just pop up and say, oh, let me tell you how you do that, you know, and they really knew. It's more difficult today because there's more fragmentation. You know, there's more frequencies. There's little niches of people here and there, not as many large groups as there used to be on ham radio. So QRZ, the forums there, provide you a place where you can actually get with a group of guys of like understanding or whatever. You can ask a question, and chances are within a few days somebody's going to answer that question. Don't you find that to be a real asset?
Absolutely. In fact, our questions and answers forum is one of the most popular ones that we have. And we have literally thousands of articles, or not really articles, but the postings there and questions. It's really the Elmer's area and an invaluable resource for all of our members.
Why don't you, if you would, kind of acquaint the folks with a few of the features. Maybe there's some new things you've added, but some things that maybe folks are missing when they go to QRZ.
Nothing stays a secret for very long on QRZ. Earlier this year, I introduced a new, basically a new set of call sign pages that provide the Google Maps on every call sign. One of the things that's quite nice, really, is when you pull up the map on QRZ, there's a little right below the map, there's a little link that says Explore on Grid Map. And when you pull that page up, you get a map of your hometown or right around your TH with a square showing which grid square you're in. And this particular page, which is what we call the Grid Mapper, has an option to where if you click on the link that says Show Hams, it shows you all the hams that are in that particular grid square and the surrounding grid squares as well, and you can pick the squares or type them in. It's truly a unique view of ham radio, and basically you can look at the entire country with this view, and with a map you can actually see how ham radio is distributed in and around where you live, and in fact any place around the United States. It's very telling. And a very, very interesting part of QRZ. It's called Grid Mapper. And if you just go to QRZ.com and type in www.qrz.com/gridmapper, one word, you can get a view of all the hams in any grid in the United States, and for outside the United States, at least know for any town, any location on the globe, what the grid square is for that location. So that's a piece that I largely put together myself with some research on the net, and something I'm pretty proud of.
Well, that's very cool. That is really cool. And, of course, there's fellas that almost make a career out of grid chasing, so that would be an interesting thing for them. I'm extremely compelling part of the website. What I said, some of the things as folks may be missing, because every once in a while I discover something that's there that I didn't know was there. And you think you've seen the whole site, but in reality, most folks probably haven't seen the entire site. And I guess what I was asking is, what do you think is something that is probably easily missed that people would enjoy?
In the QRZ forums, there's a lot of things going on that don't necessarily come to the forefront. For example, we have a help center, which people are encouraged to go to ask questions about the website, and we actively solicit users to help each other there, and we have a couple of users that have been around for so long, we've given them special privileges so that they can actually help people out with call sign changes and things of that nature. You talk about the QRZ forums, we have the Ham Radio News Forum. We've also got a whole section set aside for contests and de-expeditions. We've got an active HamFest calendar section with over 1,000 listings in there for HamFest. Now that includes, the listings from the past as well. Our ham radio gear for sale, 71,000 listings in there. 25,000 listings in the trade area. We also have general merchandise where you can sell literally anything. You know, if you it doesn't matter. We just basically allow sales of any type of items in there. As I mentioned before, our questions and answers forum, that's 36,000 articles in there. There's 321,000 replies there. So that kind of says that for every question asked, you get 10 replies. So you'll certainly get an opinion, no matter what you ask in there. We have an Elmer's Corner dedicated just to Elmer's and how to become a ham. We have an equipment review section where people submit their thoughts and opinions on equipment. I guess what I'm trying to say here is that our ham radio forums are very large. We have well over 100,000 articles in there and close to 500,000 replies and comments to those articles. So, you know, it's a huge warehouse, and let me say this, everything on QRZ is indexed in Google as well. So if you're looking for a particular, you know, for a particular subject matter, just go on the left side of the QRZ page, and you'll see a little box there that says Google search. Fill that in, and you'll have, you know, the best search engine in the world accessing all of those, you know, 500,000 articles. So, you know, that's something that people should know about.
If folks, let's just say a person is a non-ham, and they want to log in to QRZ because they're wanting to get their ham license and whatnot, how is that handled? Are they welcomed in without a set of call signs?
Yes, anybody can log in. Anybody can have an account at QRZ. We do restrict right participation. In other words, you can't start an article in some areas unless you have a call sign, but you can read any article, and we certainly welcome everyone. Like I said earlier in the broadcast, our online practice tests have helped thousands of people join the hobby, and it remains a very popular part of the website.
And of course, that includes all classes. In other words, it's the technician, general, and extra. You can go up and study or take mock tests up there, and
that's right.
And see how you do before you face
that's
the
right.
music. Well, I don't want to keep you. I know you've got many things to do, and you've been very kind coming on and talking with us. And if you have anything else, any additional comments, anything that you'd like to say to the listening audience about QRZ or any final comments, go right ahead. The floor is yours.
Okay, well, thank you, Ted. Well, I want to thank you as well for having me on. I especially want to thank the online ham radio community for helping QRZ become what it is today. Every day I get emails and from people encouraging me to keep going, and I will say this right now, QRZ is going to continue indefinitely. As long as I'm able to type, I'm going to keep QRZ running. I especially want to thank those that contribute to the site. I want to thank all of our advertisers and those that sign up and subscribe to our various services. We will, from time to time, introduce new services, and those that are existing customers will certainly be the first to know about that. And all I can say is thanks to everyone for helping keep this going, because what started out as a hobby for me has now become really my entire life. And when I get up in the morning and I look at the TV and it shows all the traffic conditions around town, I just can't be thankful enough that my job is QRZ, and all I have to do is walk down the hall and sit down in front of the computer, and it's one of those jobs where I can't believe that I earn a living from doing it, because really it just is so much fun and so rewarding from everyone. So thank you all.
It operates 20 through 10 meters. It's stealth. It will keep up with any three-element beam and any vertical that you have on your property. But if you can't have a three-element beam or a vertical on your property, you can still have a TW2010. It is stealth. It disappears. We tried to take pictures of it, and we had to move the thing around because it hides so well. There is no compromise in performance with this antenna, and it's portable. You can take it with you on vacation. It's quite unique. They make several flavors of this antenna, however. If you want to operate 80, 40, 60, 30-meter band, it's all there. Go to their website and check it out, transworldantennas.com. That's transworldantennas.com, and check out the special pricing right now. Well, that's going to do it. That's all the time we have for QSO this week. Be sure and join us again for another QSO.